KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, the writer and explorer Craig Childs is with us. It's not always easy to find the guy, let alone pin him down for an interview. Childs wanders a lot and all over. His latest book is a very unique kind of travel log. In it, he tries to imagine what it was like for the first people who arrived in this continent during the Ice Age. He calls the book An Atlas of a Lost World. We'll be right back.
Want to take full control of how you give to KUER? If you're already a sustainer, you can sign up for MyKUER. You'll be able to update your contact and payment information, make changes to your monthly gift, and even leave us a message. Think of it like getting into the driver's seat. It's up to you where we go. Sign up for MyKUER at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, the writer and explorer Craig Childs is our guest. When we talked to him from Arizona, he said he was glad that we had found him, which isn't always easy. Childs lives off the grid in Colorado, and he's known to disappear for weeks, to wander off in the desert of the Southwest. He writes about these excursions, trying to understand the native people who once lived there, how they looked for water, how they managed scarce resources, basically how they lived and why they eventually left. His latest book is a similar kind of exploration of an ancient people. This time, he goes way back to the end of the Pleistocene, to the Ice Age, about 20,000 years ago, when there was a land bridge that gave access to this new world, a place teeming with animals. The book is a travelogue. He goes to these places to trace their path and figure out how they lived and why they came in the first place. The book is called Atlas of a Lost World. Childs says he first started thinking about these ancient people years ago when he was working with a crew of archaeologists, and he started wondering what this continent would have been like before humans. He was excavating the skeleton of a camel. This was in Colorado, in Porcupine Cave.
That's where I first started imagining this book. But wow. But then you're imagining, what was it like? This camel was here before people.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit older than human arrival. And what was it like to be on half of the planet that had no people at all? And so that kind of stirred my imagination to look at an animal world. And then what happens when you open the door and people come in?
You write about how that camel, had it somehow come to life, would have been entirely bewildered to have seen anything like you, a creature like a human.
Yeah, I think there was nothing at all like us, and certainly no campfires, no yeah. range of a thrown spear or an atlatl. And just, I thought, what would I look like? Would I look like some kind of crab, or what would the camel think I was?
What was the idea about the idea of this atlas? Because you say in the book that you were thinking about this time before there were humans here, and then as they arrive, and that you were thinking that to orient yourself in that time, you were going to need an atlas. What do you mean?
Yeah. You need, first of all, you have to get up on a high point, because that's the way that when I don't have a map, or even when I do, it's look for the nearest ridgeline, hilltop, anywhere where you can get up and look around and get a lay of the place. And that's what the idea of the atlas is that you're looking at an unknown landscape, a place you've never seen before. And where do the rivers go? What's past the next mountain range over? Just how far does this all go, and where are the coastlines? Where are the lakes? Where are animals you can eat? Where are animals that will eat you? So the atlas is just the lay of the land, which in the Ice Age, if you're a human and you are a minority species, you're going to have to get a feel for where you are and how to survive here.
Very early in the book, you say you call it a love story. The kind of meet cute is when, as you put it, our hungry, inquisitive species meets a land that hasn't known humans. So you put it that way, as a kind of a relationship in some way.
Yeah, because it is, it's people figuring out a land and the species on that land, but it's in a way that land figuring out the people too, the species learning how to adapt to this new animal. We must have been really something. The first humans, first of this species walking onto this continent with domestic wolf dogs, with spears and skins and tools. This is not something that animals really knew. So it would have been a dance that went on for thousands of years of how do humans fit in and how does everything else around them react?
One of the big questions, of course, is why did they come? And you mentioned, you know, they weren't really colonizers. They didn't necessarily have an invasion in mind or any great colony in mind necessarily. What was it? What was it about initially? A place to live? A sense of exploration? A little of all of that?
Yeah, I think it's a little of everything. And it's one thing that doesn't show up in the archaeological record is adventure.
Yeah.
And this is a very basic human function is, what's beyond that mountain range? Let's go out and have something exciting and different happen. And it's, you know, groups coming together, breaking apart, resources becoming scarce in one place, or, you know, dire wolves driving people out of a home territory. So I think there are all these push and pull factors, especially when humans would have been so few. So they would have been very susceptible to small changes, and this would have kept driving them into new areas. But I do think the human need to see what's past the horizon, to map out the territory, is a big factor in why people would have kept moving into hostile landscapes or seemingly infinite landscapes.
Yeah. Can you relate to that? There's this moment we'll get back to, and which is this, that these people may have been genetically inclined, built, evolved to have a kind of a certain gene that makes them actually look for adventure, to be restless. And I'm wondering if you relate to it in that way.
Yeah, I definitely relate to it. There is a chromosomal restlessness that is maybe an excuse for why some of us do what we do. But there is something that is spring-loaded in our genes that some of us just take off. And I definitely feel that. Yeah. I am always looking at the horizon. But at the same time, I know I travel with people who really have it, who they just keep going and going, and they never return. And I guess I do also have the home gene where I need to come back and sit down and write and say, oh, this is what I saw out there. So I feel the combination, the urge just to go, just to find a place that is beyond anything you've seen before and disappear into it, but then also return and write the story down.
Yeah. The book is also about, gosh, it's almost as much about the animals, of course, as the humans. And let's talk a little bit about what, we'll get to some particulars as we go, but give us a broad sense. Mostly, I have to say, the thing that was really compelling, at least early on, is this idea that the cold climate of this time made these creatures, many of them anyway, just huge.
Yeah, it's a universal response from mammals that when the general environment gets colder, the mammals get bigger. They have to hold on to their heat, so they have bigger bones, more muscle, more fat, more fur. And while this is happening, you know, these are generally herbivores that are getting bigger, and the predators are getting bigger to match them. So the herbivores get bigger to fend off the predators, and you know the race goes on. So in these cold environments, things just go up. So you get these giant ground sloths that are standing one story tall, or everything is going to the top end.
The feeding habits of a mammoth, you point out. I have to say, I'll just point this out, taking in 600 pounds of forage a day and then 400 pounds of crap, of dung.
Yeah. Yeah, they are moving a lot of biomass through them. So it's a different kind of world than we're in. It's not just that the animals are bigger, but they're processing more. So there's this flow of nutrients. Everything's getting overturned and trampled and eaten. And so it's in a way a more dynamic, active ecosystem than we are in now.
And I like how you put it in the book where you say that the way we today think of like traffic, a traffic jam, or how we speak in texts, like the ordinary quotidian stuff of our lives today, that's what it would have been like to just live with these animals. The place was packed with animals.
Yeah, it's I feel like we maybe always have the same level of stress in our lives, whether it's Ice Age or now. It's just that in the Ice Age, the stressors or the dynamics that we had to be involved with were don't get eaten, stay on your toes because there are saber cats around. Whereas now it's merge onto this onto interstate traffic, and we've replaced saber tooths with us in many ways as our primary stressor.
Well, there's a story that you tell that is kind of gets to that point. You, this is 3 degrees below the Arctic Circle. This is St. Lawrence Island. It's sort of the last remnant of the land bridge that stretched out from the Bering Strait, and you had gone there with your mother, which is interesting. I have to say that this is another important part of the book, and we'll get back to it, the idea of you having these companions and the kind of interpersonal human dynamics of these expeditions is an important part of it, because you're trying to imagine what it was like for early people to interact in abundance and dire circumstances. But we'll get back to that. But just talk a little bit about this moment when you go, you get permission from the Yupik elders at St. Lawrence to venture out a little bit. You weren't supposed to go this far. You went a little further than you maybe should have gone. And anyway, you're encountering these two wolves. I'll get you to the story. And you really were afraid. And I wanted you to talk about this moment.
Yeah, the people in the village, it's a Siberian Yupik village, they had been warning me about the wolves, and they're also polar bears. So they'd say, well, you got to be careful with the wolves. And I would say, well, wait a minute, what about the polar bears? And I, you know, I knew wolves from the lower 48 and some in Alaska, and generally they're all running the other way. They keep their distance. And when these wolves were coming toward me on the tundra, that's where I just went, oh, I get it. I mean, there's no place to hide out here. There's not a tree or a rock or anything, and you're completely exposed and utterly vulnerable. And I don't think about that with wolves. But now I'm going, okay, what is this kind of wolf like? These two came across probably on pack ice from Siberia at some point in the past, and so this is not a kind of animal that I really understand. Do I really want to be tangling with wolves? So I ducked down into a draw and started hurrying my butt back toward the village. But it was this moment where I had dismissed them, where the people were giving me the warnings, and I was thinking, oh, they must be giving, you know, a warning to a stranger. This must be what they say to kids to keep them from running off from the village. But then it felt really real, and I've had a lot of encounters with animals before, but this was this fear of, well, are they just checking me out, or are these wolves actually coming down here to hamstring me and take me down? And oh, this must be a taste, just the smallest taste of what it was like in the Ice Age, that Ice Age people would have seen me hightailing it away from these what would have been relatively small wolves compared to Ice Age, and they would have just said, God, what happened to our species? Why is that guy so afraid?
Well, that is one of the questions you ask. You said, have we forgotten what it's like to inhabit that kind of fear, and what have we lost? What did you think about that? What have we lost if we don't have that same kind of fear? If we have to go to St. Lawrence Island to encounter that kind of actual, real, just gut-wrenching fear?
Yeah, I think we've lost a lot. We've replaced it with a lot too, we've lost an interconnection with the movement of animals and weather and geography and how it all ties together. that you would have been able to look at these animals and you would have known what they were up to. I think we've lost the ability to talk to animals, and I look back to the old stories where animals are speaking in our language, and I think, oh, there must have been a time that we actually, we could look at them and go, oh, I know what they're thinking, I know what they're doing, they know what I'm doing, and we communicated. Whereas now, the land itself seems foreign. The animals seem foreign. It seems like we've really split off as a species.
I want to ask you about something that you explore in the book, and it's this idea that in some ways we really aren't that much different from those people thousands of years ago who arrived. I think it's interesting the way we're inclined to want to think that they were completely different, almost not evolved in the same way we are. But one of the things that, for example, you quote this archaeology professor at Arizona State who said this, and you quote him in the book, a child from 20,000 years ago would be a fully modern human, well within the range of variation of modern humans today, which I found really fascinating. And it seems like that's almost a theme in the book in some ways. We're not all that different.
Yeah, I really want to go back to that to say, you know, we do think of these as cave people who are grunting and scratching in the dirt, and they were us. They were anatomically modern Homo sapiens, and for me that says, oh, they had our same range of emotion, of capacity for love or fear or regret, and so it makes it a lot more real for me to think that we have a connection that goes back that far, and you know, I think it serves the purpose to separate us, to say that these are just you know, monosyllabic cave people. And and so that means, oh, we are at the top of the heap now, when actually, no, we probably were capable of the same atrocities and wonders back then. But now we're a new experiment. We are them with nuclear weapons. We are them with cities, highways, cell phones. What do we do now? Because we are essentially cave people dressed up.
Yeah. And they weren't a blank slate, you say. I mean, they had cultural traditions. They had their own ideas, their own concepts of how the world worked and where they came from, I guess.
Yeah, they showed up with artifacts that you can trace back. You can see the use of red ochre in ceremonies. That comes right out of Siberia and the Pacific Rim and right across the land bridge and down into North America. So they're bringing complex languages, technologies that they picked up along the way. They're bringing architecture. The first structures that were built showed up in Siberia and then across the way in Alaska. So they're a fully developed a people. So they had everything they needed.
When the first humans arrived here, between 24 and 15,000 years ago. That's the general range, I think, if I gather.
Yeah, I think that's a safe number. Yeah. I think it'll keep going back, but right now that's where we are.
As we keep learning. But what was it like? What would it have looked like? I mean, this was a time when ice of that ice age was at its maximum. So what did it look like?
In a way, it didn't look that different. I mean, if you were near the ice, of course, you'd just see the giant ice cap. But the same mountains were here then, the same rivers. You know, in Salt Lake, you would have seen glaciers pouring down out of the mountains. Salt Lake would have been Lake Bonneville. It would have been enormous and grazed by horses, mammoths. You would have seen giant ground sloth and essentially the plant life would have been like it is 1,000 feet higher. So so the city would have been more forested, lusher. Yeah. And I think about, you know, southern Utah. I think about what the desert would be like, because there's so much more recharge out of the mountains of fresh water. The springs would have just been gushing.
Talk a little bit more about the ice, because you and this is a really great part of the book, I have to say, where you're wondering what it would have liked to have been to travel on these ice sheets as these people did, and It must have been just incredibly dangerous. You talk about walking out on the edge of the Greenland ice sheet, for example, to kind of get that perspective. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's where you were talking about the horizons and you know, the human need to go. I looked across the ice sheet there, and you're standing at the edge looking out into it, and it's just white that goes on forever. And you know that this goes on for hundreds and hundreds of thousand miles of emptiness. For them, it would have been at least 2,000 miles of ice between Alaska and the nearest landfall. And when you're standing out there, there's a gravity to the horizon. And I felt pulled by it, where I thought, oh, I could start walking here. And I knew that, well, that means that you're either going to die tonight or tomorrow night.
Yeah.
that you can't live out there. And still there was this draw. Still the land pulled on me because it said, here is an unknown place. Here is an emptiness. And there must be something about us, and maybe about every species, that when there is an emptiness, they move into it. And I think it's both a wonderful and dangerous habit of ours, because I love to move into emptiness, but then I look at 7.5 billion people moving into every emptiness that they can find. What do we do then? So I feel like I'm in between obeying this gravity and being repulsed by it, because I think, oh, this need to pioneer, to go out, where does it end?
Yeah.
It just keeps going and going. And what do you devour yourself if you can't find another horizon?
So you did go out on an ice field on the Kenai Peninsula. This is one of the excursions that you took in the book. And I wanted to ask you about the experience of it, because I think what's really interesting, part of the story, as I was referring to earlier, were these kind of group dynamics that you encountered, because you would go out with people often. Yeah. I mean, you often go alone, but you would go out with people. And talk a little bit about this particular excursion, because you had at moments people like Q, who wanted, let's get the hell out there and go. And then another person named Sarah Gilman, who was a little bit more cautious and careful, because it was, after all, you encountered what sounds like a terrifying whiteout, but just the kind of the group dynamics of this. I'm wondering what you learned about that, and how this fits into the story that you tell.
Yeah, it was very important for me to be with a group on a lot of these trips, because I don't think people in the Ice Age would have been alone. You would have been eaten fast, and there were too many variables, and so I selected groups, or we self-selected ourselves, and for this ice trip, this group came together, and it was experienced people. Everybody was capable, but then you get into the dynamics out there. Like you said, Q wanted to go, and Sarah was saying, you know, I don't think we've practiced our rescues right. Well enough here. We're dealing with crevasses, and I think that it took both of them to make a trip. You have to have somebody who's saying, we're going to go against all odds. We're just going to be out there. And you have to have somebody else saying, well, we need to actually survive. And between the two of them, you get this balance. And we also had a friend who was turning 60 out there on the ice, who was the most experienced ice person, and he was the one saying, okay, well, let's wait it out an hour and have a little bit to eat and then see how we feel. So I'm watching a tribe form.
Yeah.
Who's in charge? But then it's not a ruler. It's just somebody who has a better idea. And then who's going to kind of fuel it underneath? Who's going to be cautious? Who's going to be adventurous? And between all of these people, we get to where we were planning on going.
It just made me, I have to say, really imagine what it was like for those people. It absolutely brought those people to life for me. When I imagined, you know, people arguing in a tent, or someone trying to be cautious, someone being maybe reckless, someone saying, let's figure all of this out, it made me feel like those group dynamics aren't all that different either in that sense.
I think we have this almost one-dimensional vision of people who would have been around that far back.
Yeah.
And we see them all agreeing with each other without speaking and moving forward. But it was the same thing. There were conversations late at night of somebody going, should we really be doing this?
Yeah.
I don't think this is a good idea. I think I want to bail on this trip. So I think they were the same. And there's a level of empathy that I think we have to have for the past that will help us a lot with the present and the future when we can see these individual moments that would have happened in the Pleistocene, which means we're not alone here in this moment in human history, that there's so much, it extends around us in all directions.
Well, and you write about how one of the reasons for migration may have been is that people kept going because they were hoping to find someone else. They were looking for others. They were looking for each other.
You don't survive in a small group. You've got way too much landscape, and you have to find other people, and that's just a genetic reality.
Yeah.
If you got a group of 15 or 20, eventually you're going to die off without some fresh genes moving into your group. So they were probably looking for other people out there. I don't think it was the case where you would have seen other people and gone, oh, no, enemies.
Yeah.
There are other beings with hands in this world of fangs and tusks. It must have been just amazing to find another group of people.
It gave me another view of tribalism, I have to say, Craig. I think, we've done a few shows lately where people are talking about that biological impulse to, stay within your tribe. And this made me think a little differently, that maybe we're more social than that. And that seems kind of like a hopeful thing.
Yeah, we're definitely more social. We are, I think this tribalism that we're experiencing right now is kind of unusual in human evolution, because most of the time you need another group, other people to encounter, who can be your map to what's ahead, who have information, and especially in frightening terrain where there are big animals, where you can run into somebody else who says, oh, don't go down that valley. It's just full of saber tooths. Try this pass over here. And we would help each other, because who else has this information? And who else has you need genetic input. You need to meet other groups of people and say, oh, we could mix. We could help each other out. We could help each other survive. And out on the edge of the world, you need all the help you could get.
Craig Childs, his new book is called Atlas of a Lost World, Travels in Ice Age America. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Do you work for the University of Utah? Are you a public radio nerd? Then donate to KUER through payroll deduction. Decide how much of your paycheck you'd like to put toward programming like Morning Edition, 1A, and Radio West, and the university will send your generous gift to KUER. Your contribution supports factual journalism, Utah stories, and even short films. Get started with payroll deduction by looking under the support tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer and explorer Craig Childs. We're talking about his book, where he tries to imagine what it was like for the first people who arrived in this continent during the Ice Age. The book is called Atlas of a Lost World. I wanted to have you say something about, you mentioned red ochre a little bit earlier, and you carried with you this small bit of red ochre there on the Kenai Peninsula. And I just wanted to mention that I'm not sure it was a ceremony you exactly enacted, but it had various functions, ochre, and one of them was to paint your skin for decoration, and you painted your faces. I just wanted you to tell that story. I thought this was nice.
Yeah, and this was actually before I knew red ochre is this major archaeological component, that it was a ceremonial stone that's been used by humans since the beginning, since 70,000 years ago in a cave in southern and South Africa. So that there's a whole history of ochre, but I had ochre because I thought it was a cool rock.
Oh, is that right? Stumbled upon a deep impulse in humans to do something with ochre.
Yeah, I found it in the Bright Angel Shale in the Grand Canyon, and I went, oh, this is a beautiful pigment. You add water to it, and you can paint things with it. So I just scratched some out, and I've been carrying it for 20 years. And on a particularly good day, which is maybe every 5 or 8 years, I'll pull it out and say, hey, you guys, I've got some ochre. Let's paint ourselves with it. And we had a day like that on the ice sheet where just a miraculous day, one of those days that you wanted never to end. And toward the end of the day, I pulled out the ochre and Sarah Gilman, who is also the artist for this book.
Yeah, your stuff is great.
She put ochre in her palm, ground it up, added water, and then painted our faces. So it wasn't really ceremonial. It was more just fun at the end of the day. But maybe it was ceremonial because this is what humans have done since the beginning. And then we all have painted faces and are running around on the ice. And, you know, it's like we're playing primitive, but we're not playing primitive. We're way out there. We have struggled and gone through storms and made it out there. And this was my version of a celebration. And that may have been what it was 20,000 years ago, is, hey, let's celebrate. Let's say we are here and let's paint ourselves and remember this day.
Turns out in the late Pleistocene, you write about how humans had larger brains than we do now. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, what was different about their brains and how did it make them see the world differently, do you think? I mean, they had more variables that they had to contend with, at least in terms of dangers, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing because it's hard to tell what actually is missing in our brains from theirs. It's just the size of the brain case. So it could have been that their brains were a little looser. Domestic animals tend to have smaller brains, and you might say we are domestic animals. And one of the reasons that you have smaller domestic brains is because the aggression centers are not as advanced, so that we can live together without eating each other. And back then, it could also be that they did have far more physical variables, where we've got variables that require compact parts of the brain that are, you know, calculating numbers or dealing with social circumstances. But back then, I think they were dealing with such a root base world of tooth and claw and weather that the variables coming in may not need the really compact parts of the brain, may need the larger parts of the brain that say, you know, take the brunt of this and go into it and deal with it on a very physical level. And that's not what we're always doing. I think we spend a lot more time with intellectual concepts and relationships. So that may have led to our smaller brains.
But you also say that they must have been pretty sophisticated communicators. Do we know in terms of what the language would have been like or the way they communicated?
Well, it was some kind of Indo-Eurasian language. It's linguistics are pretty complicated because so many people came over prior to the very late European arrival. And so you have all these different groups that are coming from Siberia, coming from the coast, bringing different genetic histories, bringing different languages. So there were probably many languages that came across during the Ice Age, dialects of each other. So it's not a simple monolithic history at all. And linguistically, granted, we're not around to hear what they were saying, but we can see how languages moved back and forth, that there was a Navajo-like Athabascan language that developed in North America and actually returned to Siberia and is found there now. So, so it's been going both ways.
You tell a story in the book about being with a friend in a desert in New Mexico where you were looking for You're looking for mammoths or mammoth tracks, Colombian mammoths. Talk a little bit about this, what you were looking for there. These prints, I have to say, sound kind of extraordinary. I mean, they're out there. It's hard to imagine that there are, and they're not in the stone. They're there in this soft sediment, which makes it sound incredibly fragile.
Yeah, these tracks are like pie crusts or just discolorations. But you can see the actual trackway where a mammoth walked in a shallow lake bed, which is now, you know, the edge of White Sands in New Mexico, and left the pattern of its track. So you're standing in the place where a mammoth actually occupied the airspace. And that really helps for imagining what was happening there. And then these tracks just disappear after a while. They're not fossils. They're not they haven't turned to stone. They're just sediment. So the wind scrapes them and brings them to the surface, and then they disappear. And they found giant ground sloth tracks down there, but they found human prints in the tracks. So you can see, and it looks as if the ground sloth turned around to deal with whatever was coming up from behind it. And the human tracks are jumping from one ground sloth track to the next, so it's bigger than a normal human stride. So they're stepping intentionally in these tracks. These are the kinds of things that I'm just like, oh, I should have held on to this book for another year. Could have added that into it.
Yeah. You write about what it would have been like for the Clovis people to have seen the end of an era. The end of the Ice Age, and what kind of violence came along with that. But then, this part of the book, you connect that with modern violence. Tell us a little bit about Nick and the connection here that you see.
Yeah, Nick, he's a dear friend of mine who was a bomb tech, a bomb diffuser in Iraq. So as we're out there looking for mammoth tracks and thinking about Clovis and mammoth hunters, right next to us is the White Sands Missile Range. So we're seeing, you know, plumes of smoke coming up from missile impacts, and he's talking about his knowledge of weaponry, of you know, opening a car trunk and seeing this bomb inside and booby traps and you know, bodies are around him and the world is smoldering, and I'm looking at Clovis tools and saying, well, you know, it might not be that different. It's just that there are more of us and our technology has changed, but we're still making killing weapons and we're, you know, you mentioned what the Clovis people witnessed, the end of the Ice Age. The end of the Ice Age was a catastrophic time, giant floods, biblical floods, sea level rises that are just bewildering. And then extinctions are happening and the ice is retreating and advancing. There are a lot of significant changes going on. And so Nick and I are just out in the dunes talking about this, him saying, yeah, this is what we do as a species. We kill, that's the best thing we do. Because he's seen it. He's seen the kinds of weapons that we make, and he believes that this is the highest technology we know how to do, which is the same in Clovis time. The points they were making, stone points, were some of the finest stonework ever seen in the world.
It's so interesting that you kind of had this Goldilocks time about 16,000 to 14,000 years ago. Things were kind of perfect, you know, lots of water, lots of good land and animals, and then you mentioned the violence of this time that comes when the air is changing, when ice dams start to break and glacial dams are breaking, and you see large portions of landscapes that are just basically erased. And the way the people dealt with that, I found really fascinating. And part of that, at least as I understand this, Craig, and help me understand this, is that the Clovis, they kind of created a culture to cope with all this destruction or this fact that they didn't know what to do with it. And part of it was killing large animals that they didn't necessarily need to kill.
Yeah, this was a time when you see many more megafaunic hills than earlier. So something changed, and it's not that they're just eating giant animals. There's more evidence that they were eating rabbits and deer. But when they were using these big weapons, they're always associated with big animals. So it's almost as if they had a ceremonial relationship with it, much like the northern whale hunts in indigenous cultures, that this isn't just a hunt. It's a big community gathering, and that may have been the reaction. One archaeologist I talked to said that this may have been a cult, yeah. Because this technology spread way too fast for, you know, usually you have the same technology for thousands of years, and then within 200 years, Clovis technology covered North America, which means this meant something to people. This was part of people's cultural identity that traveled around, and I think it was, I agree with this archaeologist that this was the human reaction to enormous change, where they said, well, we're going to make ourselves huge. We're going to kill the biggest animals. We are going to dominate this landscape. We are going to be the most powerful thing here, and we will not fail. We will not die. And I think that is also a very human trait.
You also wonder if hunting these big animals, you know, when there were plenty of other squirrels and rabbits out there, was to create a kind of a feast, like a social gathering, and to give yourself a social position, you know, to be the person who gets the big animal is the honor. And I'm wondering, what does that say about us as a people, you know, as a species?
Yeah, well, it says that we honor skill and power, and I derive a lot of this from looking at the indigenous whale hunts. How do these communities react? And while I was writing a book, there was a 16-year-old kid who took a whale off of St. Lawrence Island, and he was just a hero. And so that elevates you, you know, it's like it's a form of government in a way. It elects this person to the higher position. And that's one aspect of it. But then when you look at Yupik communities at the same time, it's matrilineal, and the highest person on the social scale is the grandmother. So you've got one side of it being age-based and gender-based, and the other side being skill and bravery-based. And I think that maybe is like Sarah and Q on the ice. One person is safety and keep alive, and the other person is let's go crazy. And between the two, you have a tribe, you have a culture, you have a way of surviving.
You write about this cooling event. The younger, is it Dryas? Is that how it's pronounced?
Younger Dryas, yeah.
The younger Dryas, this cooling event that basically lasts 1,000 years. And you mentioned things like icebergs showing up off the coast of Florida, or what is now Florida, obviously. And this killed off a lot of the last big animals. They just couldn't. I mean, you know, you mentioned mammoths and others, this big megafauna who had managed to get through the, you know, these various ice ages. And this was they just couldn't take it anymore. And they died. And I wanted to ask you about this moment, because you said this is when humans kind of, as you put it, take the change and run with it. Talk about what's happening here. They die off. We adapt, I guess.
Yeah, and that is what we do. When there's a major climate change, we're one of the species that says, okay, we can figure out how to live in this new situation. And this was the ice age had been ending for several thousand years, warmer and warmer, and then all of a sudden it returned within possibly 10 years.
Yeah.
Everything went right back into ice age conditions, and that was just too much for the animals that were already being pressured heavily by humans. But while there were extinctions going on, humans, they diversified. This was actually where Native America starts to form, where different groups appear all across the continent, different technologies. So their response to a major climate change was to find a niche and specialize in that niche. And so suddenly you've got all kinds of different people all over the continent who are living in many different environments. So it was really this revolution that just sealed the human place on North America.
At the close of the Ice Age, we're talking some 11,000 years ago now, there are something like, I think you say, 10 groups can be identified. And they banded into these gathering places. What happens to humans at this point now? As we adapt, we get into these groups, and then we have these gathering places. This is a really interesting part of the story, I think.
Yeah, that's when you go from isolated communities that are not visited very often to these big congregations where people are coming from many different directions and spending time in one group. So you're seeing stone tools with the stones coming from 300 miles away in all directions, which suggests that it's all these different people who are saying, let's get together, let's have a big hunt, let's manufacture tools together, let's all face inward, let's be in a circle that looks in toward a center. So you're starting to see the establishment of long-range communication and people sharing ideas, probably sharing genes, mating, sharing technologies. So you're starting to get into a more advanced human presence here. And I think that is something that humans always do, that we have these big gatherings and they're full of diversity and ideas. And that's actually how I think they came through the Ice Age, that when the Ice Age ended, they came out the other end well established and in close communication with each other. So I think this is, I mean, we see it today. We see Burning Man. We see, you know, so many gatherings where people are coming from all over the world to be at one event. And I think this is really at the root of human civilization.
Part of the story is you going to Burning Man, and you make that ain't sort of connection between that kind of crazy event that happens in the desert with some of these more ancient gatherings. And you say this is how people continue. Make yourselves into one. And do you think in some way that's the hope for the future, is if we can go toward that human inclination?
I think that is one of our great hopes, because making ourselves into one, but also keeping our diversity. So we come together for a single idea, but we bring in so many other outside ideas that we can say, okay, well, what are you guys doing in Japan? And what are you guys doing in Mexico? And okay, I get a sense of what's happening in the world. This is what I'm doing over here. And we're sharing and we're getting a context and it's like I was saying earlier, you get up on a high point and you look around to see where you are. That's what we're doing culturally. We're having a look at the lay of the human landscape and saying, how can we, what ideas here are really good, that are really working, that can help us out, that can help the world out. I think this is one of our saving graces. And even if it's, I mean, looking at Burning Man, you know, we walked across the desert to get there.
Yeah.
I remember being camped out on the edge, still looking in. We weren't there yet. And all of us just going, oh, my God, do we really want to walk into this?
Yeah.
Like, this is a big, scary species. We make plumes of flames and lasers and sounds. And whereas we've been walking for days out here in the desert, and it has been really sweet. So I feel torn between this. Part of me is going, yes, join the human movement, join together, combine ideas, and get as far away from humans as you can. So I'm in both camps.
At this point, you kind of asking that big question, you know, can we change the course we're on? Can we come back to where we were, you know, at a time when we've entered this new age now, widespread extinctions, unraveling climate. How has this left you all in terms of the thinking about that?
Well, it's left me knowing that you don't go back. It's always a new creation. it's left me hopeful, but also afraid. Hopeful in that I can see that we have these innate desires to come together and share, but scared also in that I saw plenty of early human remains in the Americas and elsewhere in the world that are riddled with spear points that are. That you can see that things didn't work out, and it wasn't between humans and other animals. It was between humans and humans. And so part of me is thinking, oh, it's the same old stuff. We have not changed. We are still going to kill all the mammoths or whatever else it is we're going to kill all of. And so that part, I think, oh, can't we come to a different solution here? But maybe in these gatherings, we can come to a different solution. Maybe we are far enough ahead and we've seen new variables that we can start to say there's a way to do this without destroying everything around us and without destroying ourselves. So I'm hopeful coming out of it, but terrified, which is probably where we should always be, watching very carefully, assessing, but also looking at the best possibilities and trying to angle toward that.
Craig Childs, his book is Atlas of a Lost World, Travels in Ice Age America. Craig joined us from the studios of Arizona Public Media in Tucson. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.